Society, March 23, 1972. The speaker is Dr. Ernest Wolfe, University of Alaska.
I know that some of you in this audience know more about this subject than I do. Lived many of these events that I'm going to talk about. But I think that it's an interesting, extremely interesting subject, and it's interesting to me anyway, and I'm going to go ahead and talk about it. Really, it's just a chronology of what happened. And I think that perhaps for the first 40 years of Alaska's existence, well, I shouldn't say that, first 80 years maybe, but I consider that the existence of the interior started with the Klondike Stampede. So that for those next 40 years, the history of mining was a history of Alaska. The Russians gave up Alaska in 1867. And I know that many of you know more about the history before that time than I do too. But it's from reading a few books like the biography of Baranoff and the biography of his father-in-law, Ritsenoff. The Russians were in the Aleutians during the mid-1700s practically, but their real history started too about the late 1700s or about 1800 when Baranoff finally established a good colony at Kodiak, and they were hunting sea otters. This is primarily what they were interested in. It was a fur trading company, and they had not much interest actually in mining. They probably wouldn't have been able to do anything with anything they mined anyway, but certainly gold would have been welcome if they could have located some of that. There's even there used to be a belief extent that the Russians didn't want any mining. They believed, and probably rightfully, that it would injure the fur trading that they were primarily interested in. So I have a chronology here that I made up at one time, and the first item in this chronology, and many other people's chronologies, usually starts with 1849, when a fellow named Doroshin, Peter Doroshin, a mining engineer who'd been brought out by the company, worked in Kenai, and he mined coal there. They could always use coal, and it was pretty easy to find, as it is easy to find today. They just pick it up on the beaches. He also is supposed to have mined a little gold on the Russian River, on the Kenai. However, this is all the books ever have to say about mining by the Russians. Later on, several Russian half-breeds do enter into the picture, and some of the discoveries in the interior were made by men of this extraction. The next time that mining enters the picture, as far as I've been able to find out from the literature, was in 1862, which was still in Russian times, and this discovery was on the Canadian side of the line. I don't know if they had a boundary at that time. The boundary goes up the crest of the Coast Range now, but it's in what is now the province of British Columbia. And this was on the Stikine River. There's a fellow named Choquette. He's supposed to have found some placer gold on the bars of the Stikine. These names don't mean very much anymore. I don't know that they ever did, but because of the early times in which they worked, they have been recorded and passed down, and are to be found in the literature now. Most of this, where it is written down in the literature of the U.S. Geological Survey. Brooks was in the country very early, and of course this was before the gold rushes that really established Alaska. Brooks was here and talked to men who had lived in the country for 20 or 30 years before that, and they remembered this. 1870, about the same time, well, 8 years later, however, there was the intervening transfer from the Russians to the Americans. There was placer gold found around Sumdum Bay in southeastern, and many of you know where this is. And Sumdum Bay actually later had there's still considerable hard rock gold there. It's too low grade to work, but someday it may be the basis of an industry. In 1871, the Cassiar District was struck. This is across the line in central BC, actually. And the Cassiar has had a long and varied history. It was a gold camp. It was a gold district up to the Second World War, and there may still be some prospecting and mining there. I knew a fellow that I worked with, prospected with, who spent several years in the Cassiar, and it sounded like a typical Alaskan mining camp, the way he described it, with the same old timers who had come during the stampede and had not made it, but they stayed and eked out a living by mining and prospecting. Cassiar, of course, has another importance today, probably the center for asbestos mining in the North American continent is at Cassiar. Quebec produced most of the asbestos, which the Canadians have almost a monopoly on it. But about 15 years ago, the most important asbestos mining district shifted from eastern Canada to western Canada. And today, the Cassiar Asbestos Corporation has a new mine in a place called Clinton Creek. It's at the mouth of the 40 Mile River, so it's in an old mining district. To visit that place would give any of us a thrill. You're coming across that Yukon-Tananaw Plateau out of Dawson, and you turn north on a road that goes about, well, just 20 or 25 miles off the boundary, the 40 Mile Road. You come around a bend, and about 6 or 8 miles away, there's a plume of white dust coming up, and steam. And this is the plume from the mill. There's nothing else within miles and miles but this modern city of Clinton, the Clinton Creek, and the Clinton branch of the Cassiar Asbestos Corporation. Clinton Creek is a modern city. It has stores and shops, a modern mine and a modern mill. The next few years, it was really a discovery of placer gold or lode gold in southeastern Alaska. The same year that the Cassiar was struck, they found some gold around Wrangell, the mouth of the Stikine. Well, this time, the capital was still at Sitka. If you read the old reports, especially Brooks, he says this is a black year in United States history. They bought this thing and it provided no government at all. A military presence, and that was about it. Lawlessness was going on in southeastern, and of course there was nothing in the interior, so nobody knows about that. Well, a few more items. They found a quartz vein near Sitka, 1872. This is still a long time ago. This was named the Stewart Mine, and it never did amount to much, but it has some fame as the first hard rock discovery in Alaska. Now, I know that many of you know about this next item that I consider very important. In 1873, there were two parties reached the interior of Alaska by way of the Porcupine. They crossed the portage from the Mackenzie, and these were headed by Harper and McQuesten. Both of these men left many children and descendants in Alaska. I'm not certain I've ever run across a McQuesten, but certainly I know I've run across Harpers. And they have native blood, somewhat diluted now, but all of these early people who came to the interior married native women, native wives. Same year, we're back down in the southeastern, Windham Bay was discovered. There's still a lot of placer gold in Windham Bay, if wherever to be worked. A lot of people believe, as I do, that the price of gold is going to improve. The price of gold will go up or the value of the dollars will go down. I don't know how it works. But we think that there is going to be some more gold mining in Alaska. This name is Silva, S-I-L-V-A, Mick Silva. And another name that means nothing in history, but it does have some importance and has been passed down through the generations because of his early activity in that country. And as some of you know, and as we must remember, a gold discovery in those days was the most important event that could take place in people's lives. And the discoverer did gain some immortality. 1875, it's almost 100 years ago, the upper Yukon was reached by Chilkoot Pass for the first time. This pass probably saw more people cross it before 1900 than any other route going to the interior. When was the White Pass Railroad built? Somebody here must know. It was after 1900, wasn't it? 1901, 2?
Just about
then. Yeah. Well, after that was built, it was a new ball game, of course, but before that, they had to walk across the pass. 1877, Stewart Mine comes in again for a very insignificant item. They built a mill there, and I'm sure they went broke the first year. But at any rate, they did bring a mill north, 5 stamps, and put it up. 1879, we're getting close now. The naturalist John Muir and S. Hall Young, the two of them made a trip along the coast of southeastern. I suppose they started from Sitka, almost everyone else did. In fact, it was the only place that of any size of a white population. And they went clear up into Glacier Bay by canoe. The naturalists of those days were, I suppose, chiefly geologists. Now there were geologists and botanists and zoologists, just about everything, and it's surprising how good geologists they were. They reported that they thought the prospects were pretty good along there, and that's since been proved to be true. Prospects for gold. In 1880, the next year, as a result of this, the businessmen of San Francisco and Sitka sent out Joseph Juno and Richard Harris. You know all about them, Bill. One gave his name to the city and the other to the recording district. I think I'd have chosen the city if it was up to me, because nobody's ever heard of Harris. Well, they have, but nothing like Juneau. They also went by canoe, or maybe it was a small boat, but anyway, they went across from Sitka and went along the coast, and at the present site of Juneau, they did discover gold. I don't know if it was the load of the placer first, probably the placer around in Gold Creek, and then discovered the gold-bearing quartz in that area, and this is what everybody was waiting for. I understand that Sitka lost a lot of population and Juneau gained a lot about that time. It was, and there was placer mining there, and the gold was produced, although it was worked out rather rapidly. That area, all of southeastern, has been glaciated, and the glaciers swept out the large accumulations of placer gold, and anything that was found later was reconcentrated since the glaciers were there, maybe 12 or 15,000 years, maybe less. Well, there are glaciers there yet, so it's pretty hard to speak of an end of a glacial age in that country. They simply receded and retreated, and they may start up again anytime, as far as I know. But 2 years later, they erected the first stamp mill, so they were getting started right away. They placer mined for 2 years, and then, but this wasn't erected at Juneau, it was erected across the channel at Treadwell. And the same year, the next mill to be installed was at the Ebner mine in Juneau. The Treadwell had a pretty good sized load to work on. It was a dike, a mineralized dike that ran about $4 a ton. And they got the cost of mining down right off the bat. It's written up in the History of American Mining by T.A. Ricard as being one of the most efficient mines up to that time. Across the channel at Juneau, they weren't doing so well. Actually, I'll mention this a little bit later when we talk about the AJ. But there were a lot of small veins in the slate there at Juneau, and there was a lot of quartz mining, all right, but they just get started on one of these things and she'd peter out. They were rich enough, but there just wasn't the volume of ore in any one of them to keep a mine going. Well, a few insignificant items, really. 1884, gold found at Unga Island in southwestern Alaska. This is on this is just the base of the Aleutians, and it was a pretty well-known mine for a long time. They did produce quite a bit of gold, and it's about the only one in that whole area that did. I should mention that 1884 was the year that the mining laws were extended to Alaska, and this means Juneau Mining Center functioned for 4 years without any mining law at all. And the way they did it, of course, was through the miners' law, which had developed during the California Stampede, and it worked fairly well. Most of their law had to do with mining anyway. First thing they would do when they found a new district was to organize a mining district and to elect the most important official in the district, who was the recorder, and then to have a miners' meeting and to adopt the laws that they'd be governed by. And these only affected mining, as far as I know, but they had to take on the powers of law, and you can read all about it in California history, where they would banish people for crimes. I believe they actually they had no way of jailing them, and I think there may have been some executions too. It wasn't very satisfactory, but it was the best thing that they did have. And Chuck Herbert, in his little book on mining law, maintains that the miners' law persisted into the early 30s in the interior, to some extent anyway, and I'm quite sure it did, because at Dawson, at Wiseman, for example, where they were pretty isolated, and they did have a marshal most of the time, the meetings at the Pioneer Hall had, well, they were the only social force there was. If a man needed help and had to get outside, they'd call a meeting and pass the hat. And I'm sure there must have been some aspects of law that were taken on by the miners' meeting there. Next one's Berners Bay in 1886. Bill, you know where that is too, and I think most of us have heard of that by now. We've been trying to establish a pulp mill there for the last 2 years. It was a pretty low-grade camp, but there were about 6 or 8 mines that did operate there, and there were mills. I ran into a man, Bill, I'm going to call on you for a while here. There was a fellow that had taken over an old photographic company there. Who were the partners of the photographers there, do you remember?
Junos, Winter, and Pond.
That's it. And there was a man, I talked to him in 1953, I was there. And I went down, and this man, Winter and Pond were dead, but this man had bought them out, and in the process he'd also bought out all our holdings in Berners Bay. And he was the bitterest man I've ever talked to in my life. Just no good camp. But again, I doubt if Berners Bay mining will ever start again. They can't even get a pulp mill started there. I don't see how they can reactivate the mining industry. That same year, I've got some of these underlined. In 1880 was underlined for Juneau. 1886 certainly should be underlined too, because this was the first gold found in the interior. It was found on the 40 mile on Franklin Creek. Now, I know you people could tell me about the origin of these terms, 40 mile, 60 mile, 70 mile. Was that distance from, what was it, Fort Reliance, wasn't it? On the upper Yukon. And these were established before that time, as I understand it, the names were. But Howard Franklin found the gold there, and the bars of the 40 mile still contained gold. It was easy enough to find, and then he followed it up and actually found a placer that would produce something. Well, 1887, another little known event, and it was Phil Holdsworth told me about this one. It was a stampede to Yakutat Bay and Lituya Bay for beach placers. Again, it didn't produce much, but it, in those days, it didn't have to. If people could make $3 or $4 a day, they were perfectly happy. They'd come from places where they couldn't make 50 cents a day. Resurrection Creek, Kenai, 1888. Well, that's the first, except for Unga Island, that's the first sign of anything over to the westward. This was placer gold again. 5 years went by before I found anything interesting enough to record. And the Circle District was struck in 1893. Pitka and Ceresco, and I believe these men were supposed to have been half-breeds, or at least have native blood in them. Same year, John Minook discovered gold at Rampart. These districts are both still alive and kicking, still producing a little gold, and have right down through the years. It's interesting. I've read what Brooks had to say in that book of his, Blazing Alaska's Trails. He thought the world of Circle, he thought it was one of the finest civilizations ever created. The men were, there was no crime there, and the people were generally well educated. They brought their books with them and set up a library. And this was before the Klondike was struck. Just to show you how they were getting around the country, they found a gold at Tramway Bar in the Kyakuk River the same year. It's a long way from there. And they undoubtedly went up the river, up the Kyakuk, which is a very long journey. You cut across from, we'll say from Rampart or in the vicinity there, you could make it a lot quicker. But even to this day, there are no trails across there that I know of. The mail trail went across there up until the 30s, but nobody ever lived in there, and nobody ever, as far as I know, there's nobody in there now. 1896, which 3 years later, of course, was the discovery of gold in the Klondike District, and you all know the story of that one. Where Carmax is supposed to have, is it Carmax, I guess. He's supposed to have made the big strike on Bonanza. Henderson was in the area and had told Carmax about it, but he didn't make very much off of it. He just got on a bone creek. There were enough men in that part of the country so that it was impossible to, well, he didn't try to keep it secret anyway, but there were enough men there to tie up the whole area within a very short time. Of course, anything that happened between 96 and 98 would be kind of anticlimactic, but they did find some gold on Seward Peninsula in 97. Not at Nome, but at Ophir Creek. In 1898, that's probably the most famous story of Alaska, and it's almost impossible to believe, for me anyway, what happened that year. But how many people arrived there within a few days of each other? 10,000 anyway. And they had all been storing it up all winter, and they all arrived at Skagway about the same time. They all arrived at the foot of Chilkoot Pass about the same time, and over at Lake Linderman. When they waited for the ice to go out, and while they waited, they built little boats with whipsawed green lumber. And they all left just about the same time, and they all got into Dawson about the same time. And that, to me, is a true beginning of modern Alaskan history for the interior, anyway. Because it brought a great many men. These people got there, and a lot of them found jobs, and a lot of them got leases. But most of them just found nothing, and they had to get out and rustle or else go home. And a lot of them went home, too, but a lot of them were Americans and crossed into Alaska and started to fan out. Well, it was the Klondike Stampede, and there's also an interesting bit of information I picked up. Of course, Dawson's a ghost town now, except for, at least there's no mining to speak of. But they made a museum out of the old government buildings. But there is the information there that I think within 7 years or so, all the ground had been taken up by big dredging companies. So it ought to be a lesson for most of us. If somebody finds something that's worth a lot, well, he's not going to have it very long. same year, a little known event, the Porcupine District near Haines. Gold was discovered there. You go across the Chilkat River from the present site of the road, I don't know, maybe about opposite Kluckwan. And the Porcupine District is in there. There was quite a bit of placer gold taken out of there, but it's completely dead now. Well, they started to find things in Alaska. That same year of 98, they struck the gold at Nome. Three Swedes, Lindeberg, Brinson, and Lindblom. And Mike Walsh used to have a story about everybody was cussing the Swedes and wondering why they found the most gold, and he'd always say they dug the most holes. So maybe that's the answer to it. Kobuk Stampede. That's one of my favorites. Doesn't mean much in history, but I knew some of the men who were on it. And that year of the stampede, they didn't just go to Dawson. They thought all they had to do was get to Alaska and there was gold going to be everywhere. So 2,000 of them went to the Kobuk and landed at Kotzebue. I knew Mr. Amaral very well, who'd been on that stampede, and he said that they dropped the anchor, and he was on a schooner. They dropped the anchor, and a bunch of them had the boats over the side rowing towards the mouth of the Kobuk so as not to get left behind on this fabulous hunt they were on. But they were back pretty soon when they got tired and hungry. And they did spread out along the river. And I never got a complete chronology. I don't suppose there is anything there. But at first winter, most of them laid around in the cabins they'd built. There is a book actually published by a young fellow who was on that stampede that gives a very good account of it. They were spread up and down the river. And he said a lot of them got scurvy. Well, scurvy was still commonplace in those days. They were all discouraged. None of them actually did any prospecting at all that winter. They just got into their cabin and stayed there. And by the next year, they heard about the big strike at Nome, and a lot of them went down there, and a lot of them went out with what he called blue tickets. The Revenue Service got them out of there. But there were probably a dozen or so that remained, and they went on up the river. And the next winter, they pitched a tent over the Reed River Hot Springs. And then they went on over to the next spring, over to the Noatak, and up to the head of the Noatak, and there were six of them, and they found some money at the head of the Noatak. They called it Lucky Six Trick. Well, of course, there were a lot more going on at that time. But in 1899, the year after they got there, the Upper Koyukuk had been discovered. So about 1901 or so, they had got to the head of the Noatak and went across and built rafts. They found out Lucky Six didn't amount to much. They built rafts and went down to the Koyukuk. Amaral lost his raft on the way. I don't know how he did it. He got used to that before he was done. He only died about 2 years ago at Sitka. He was almost 100 years old. Well into his 80s, he was still roaming around the East Fork of the Chandelier looking for a prospect he'd lost years before. Those same people went to the Koyukuk and worked there, and on over to the Chandelier. Many of them did. So Amaral didn't get south of the Yukon for 48 years. 1899, they discovered the gold on the beach at Nome, and that's a familiar story, too. That's where all the lawlessness came in. They could get on a boat to Seattle and play cards all the way up and stay drunk and get off the boat, no hardship, and when they got there, they just go down to the beach and start shoveling it in. And apparently a lot of undesirable characters were attracted by that kind of life. It was not much work connected with it. 1899, the copper was discovered at Kennecott. Probably a very important event, but overshadowed at the time by all the gold that was being picked up. Copper, about the same time, was being shipped from Prince William Sound, the Latouche mine. So actually they were industrializing the country quite early. Placer tin found on Seward Peninsula in 1900. Again, a small item. It never did amount to much. They shipped that tin and still do. Now they ship tin to Texas. But in those days they were shipping it to the East Indies. It'd go maybe 3/4 of the way around the world before it got there, depending on which way it went. 1902, you all know what happened that year. Pedro had been with Brooks on an expedition down the Tanana, and he went to Circle, and he kept wanting to get back to what's now the Fairbanks District, and I think they made a couple trips across. And in the winter of 1901 and 2, they spent on Bear Creek, between Fairbanks Creek and Fish Creek, and found nothing. It's the only creek in the area that doesn't have anything. But the next summer, they did make a discovery on what's Pedro Creek, the upper end of Gold Stream. And the steamer, Barnett's steamer, had come up to present site of Fairbanks about the same time. And they saw the smoke, the story is, from Pedro Dome, and went down, and you can read that story in dozens of versions and dozens of books. But it was a big strike in Alaska, well, about the same size. It turned out to be bigger than Nome, but it was of equal importance, and the people swarmed in there, especially from Dawson, and I know many of you who knew those people quite well and know most of the stories and the way they arrived. Charlie Strandberg said he and his brother came with they had been big operators at Dawson, and they simply bought a couple of barges and loaded all their kids and a couple of mining outfits down and came in style. He got to Chena in August, or in October, he said. It was raining cats and dogs. And he went over to, across the hill to Esther, and he got a lease. He took a lay at 60%. He said that's all he could, that's the best he could do. They had to do something, and he went back to Chena, and they got all the horses they could and hooked onto their mining outfits and went on over the hill. And they beat the freeze up, mined all winter, and did all right. Of course, he and his brother became big operators in the interior. He's got children, grandchildren, I guess great-grandchildren now, all over the country. Others that I've heard tell about coming across and down to Good Pasture. That wasn't such an easy trip, but it was fast. You'd get to the Tanana and build rafts, or else come on with your horses down this side of the Tanana. Well, from then on, things moved pretty fast. There were all kinds of people here, and they were all broke, and but able to get a grub stake. And I'll just quickly run through these, and most of you know the names. Given the years, 1903, Bonnefield District, the north side of the Alaska Range. It never amounted to much, but it supported a few men right down through the years. Denali or Valdez Creek on the upper Susitna. Load tin at Lost River. This was all 1903. I knew one of those fellows in the Bonnefield, John Murphy, maybe some of you know him. And he and his partner Cook were there for 40 years. He said they were sitting on stumps on First Avenue in 1903. And everybody was cussing at camp, and there was nothing to be had. So he and his partner took off, crossed the flats, and went to the Kantishna, or to the Bonneville district, and they stayed there until they died in the late 40s. Early, I knew John in the late 50s, in fact, John Murphy. Kantishna district, still being worked. Prince of Wales Island, copper mining, they were looking everywhere. They had a smelter for 3 years at Hadley, smelting copper. That's a long time ago. That was, I think, about 1905 they opened that. Tenderfoot District, you all know where that is, at Richardson. Never was a big producer either, but it produced right up into the 30s. There's an old boiler still laying alongside the road. I guess it's the other side of Richardson. 1906 was another one of my favorites because I knew some of the men there. That was a chandelier. And that is a rather unusual story because Frank Yasuda, who some of you knew, I'm certain, was there in 1891 in Barrow. And there was a white man named Carter who showed up about the same time, and they made an agreement to prospect. Frank had married an Eskimo woman and had quite a following of natives that were able to live off the country and to move around by boat and dog team. And Frank was supposed to supply the grub stake by trading and bring it to Carter, who would be prospecting in the mountains, now the Brooks Range. They prospected for several years. You were supposed to prospect the north side 1 year and the south side the next and keep moving west. In 1906, they did strike the chandelier. And as near as I can find out, in that same year, a man named McNutt came from Chicago and should be credited as being...
Can I turn this over? just got about 2 minutes.
Well, he should be credited also. I can't even remember his first name, but there's a McNutt Mountain up there that Irving Reed named it when he was surveying there for the patent and the claims. They found some pretty good quartz there, and it certainly would have been an important camp, except that it's 125 miles overland from Beaver, and to get to Beaver is no easy matter. Well, it's easy enough, but it's expensive. You have to go by riverboat. I don't want to go into that story of the chandelier too much, but it is a fascinating story. There was another fellow in there named Marsh, who would certainly, the men that knew him and that I knew in later years all called him a con man, but by documented accounts, he's one of the greatest explorers of all times. He crossed the Brooks Range in the dead of winter by himself, living off the country. He discovered and explored the Firth River placers. He came across from the Arctic, went to Fort Yukon. He was a friend and advisor of Brooks. Brooks acknowledges him in his professional paper, The Geography and Geology of Alaska. He's a mining engineer, a geologist, and altogether I would say a great man if he'd been known at all and gotten any recognition. He carried a small theodolite with him wherever he went and made astronomical observations, and when he got to Herschel Island, where the whalers were iced in, he was able to correct his theodolite, correct his chronometers, and therefore correct his positions, and he was able to send a fairly accurate map to Brooks, along with all the fossils and things he'd collected. He got Wickersham to... He got a fellow named Soldier, who who invested heavily there to get Wickersham to appoint a commissioner in the newly formed district of Chandelier. Built a cabin there in the dead of winter at Carrow at the mouth of Flat Creek. It's about halfway between Beaver and the Chandelier. And it was occupied well into the 30s by people who kept a little roadhouse there. He stayed in the district, in the camp, and tried to promote it until, well, into the 20s. He was there. He cut the trail from Beaver to the Chandelier. He blazed it out and got a little money from the road commissioner and actually built a trail which is still usable on foot. Well, leaving the Chandelier back to the interior, 1906 and 7 Gaines Creek in the Anoka District, Talkeetna District, Yentna, we found it about the same time. This is all less than 10 years after the Klondike Stampede, so you can see that they were pretty busy. Ruby District, 1907. 1910, Long Creek, south of there. 1909, the Iditarod. The Clary Creek, Cayenne on the Kobuk District, same year, that's 1909, that's 11 years after the Kobuk Stampede. They finally found some gold there. Hughes on the Middle Kiakuk, 1910. Lower Kuskokwim, 1910, 1911, and in that era. 1910 Valdez, and any of you who have lived there, a few years back anyway, could remember the Cliff Mine and the mines that operated at Valdez. Unfortunately, most of what was discovered in Alaska, except for the mines around Juneau, were pretty small. They're rich enough, but they're worked out pretty fast, too. Mercury, 1910 to 1920, it's hard to pin it down. It didn't have a nice, clean beginning like the placer districts. It was found in the Kuskokwim region, and mercury has been and will be, again, I'm sure, a pretty important factor in Alaskan economic life. There's mercury all the way from Dillingham and Good News Bay up to Kuskokwim for quite a ways. 1911 Hammond River. Anybody who's been in the Kiakuk knows about Hammond. It's been a big producer. The deep channel there was really a marvel. I guess the guys that worked there didn't appreciate it, but I can. It was so narrow they couldn't turn a wheelbarrow around. 100 feet deep and rich. They'd get all the gold out of crevices every 150 feet or so. If they only drifted 110 feet, well, maybe they didn't get paid that winter. But they had all kinds of special scrapers and spoons and diggers that they'd get the gold out of these crevices with. 1911, same year. This is 12 years after it was discovered, the first copper was shipped out of Kennecott. Kennecott Copper Corporation today is probably the largest in the world. One of the big three or four anyway. And its exploration subsidiary, Bear Creek, is the biggest exploration company in the world. They got their start down there at Kennecott. It was the richest copper mine ever found. It's almost impossible to believe. 1912, and those of you who followed the history of placers in Alaska see we're getting towards the end of it, Shoshana was struck. 1913, and the Shoshana is on the upper Kayak, or the upper Tananaw, as you know, on the north side of the mountains, very difficult to get into. They crossed, they left from Kennecott or from McCarty and crossed glaciers to get there. And when they got there, they found that there were only two or three creeks, and they were all taken and all producing. When I came to the country, which is quite a while after many of you, long time after many of you, I remember we crossed the ferry. I came in a truck. We crossed the ferry at Delta about 4 o'clock in the morning, and old Pete Smith had to wake up the ferry tender, and he was pointed out to me as the man who discovered the Shoshone. So he didn't take it with him either. 1913, Nell Chena and Marshall on the War Yukon, both classic teams. 1914, the last one was found, and you know, that was at Livengood. Juno, with these small quartz stringers, was not able to make it. 1915, they finally got a big one going. They decided to take the whole mountain. And although the quartz stringers were rich enough, they there wasn't enough of it. So the Bradleys began. Well, it took several attempts, but they finally started to mine the slate with what gold was in it. It was large-scale mining in the modern sense. They separated the slate from the gold quartz by hand sorting. Bill, I'm sure you could tell us more about this than I know. I've heard Earl speak of it. Be a powder barge come up the inlet or up the channel every day or so. They had special barges for taking the waste out. There was an awful lot of waste, and they'd flood one side and flip over and dump the waste. There was a common belief that they killed a man every day underground, but I'm sure that wasn't so. Even in those days, it was considered bad practice in public relations. But it did go, and when they were shut down during the war by government order, as all gold mines were shut down, Twinhofer, who wrote a thesis on that mine, says they were mining rock that ran 80 cents a ton for a cost of 50 cents, and that has never been rivaled before or since. It's never been met. The open pit mines are costing, they're mining rock that runs no less than $6 a ton now. And they were mining 80 cent rock. Little chromite on the Seward Peninsula in 1916 didn't mean a thing. The United States doesn't produce any chromite. It's one of our most deficient minerals. And during the war, the government tried to get some mining going there, even if they had to subsidize it heavily, which they did. But I don't think, there may have been a little shift, but most of it's still there on the beach in Sachs. 1918, the Hyder District was discovered. This is the same district, it's called the Stewart District on the other side, and it's up at the head of Portland Canal. It's an extreme end of southeastern Alaska. 1924, I would consider an important date. The railroad was completed. It allowed the industrialization of interior Alaska because they were able to bring in dredge parts and, more important, coal. The coal allowed power to be generated, and you all know about the operation that finally took place here. A fellow named Norman Steins, and I'm sure many of you knew him, is credited, and I'm certain he did. I've heard him say so himself. Lined up the claims, the old worked out claims, and he lined up almost all of them. He said there were a few holdouts, but he got most of them, and he demonstrated that you could make money by open pit mining with a drag line. And then he sold the whole shebang to the Essie Company. And it was the basis of an industry here from When did the first dredge start? Frank, you know that. 28?
Maybe
Yeah.
Yeah, 28.
28 until 65, I guess. So there was 37 years. I made a rough calculation. It was probably something over $100,000. $100 million in the ground when that dredging started in the interior, which justified the building of the railroad. Hard to speak of the value of gold because the value changed right in the middle of it. Went from $20.67 to $35. Well, a little known item that occurred in the late 20s, 1930, early 30s, was the discovery of, or at least finally the recognition of platinum at Good News Bay. They'd been finding this stuff in the sluices, and I don't know if they threw it away or not, but they finally found out what it was. And to show you how these things work, the importance of it that a lot of people don't understand, it's the only platinum produced in North America that isn't byproduct platinum. And it's the only platinum produced by the United States. And by putting two and two together in the State Annual Report Division of Geological Survey, it looks like they produced about $400,000 last year, if you can add some things and subtract others. So that's a reasonable return after all these years. And the end isn't in sight. The price keeps edging up. 1930, the Nabesna. A lot of you remember that. Carl Whittem roamed those hills for years. He found it, he developed it, he mined it out, and went through the whole cycle. I think they produced just under $2 million. 1930, the copper on Prince William Sound ended. 34, price of gold went up. A lot of you remember that. And then everybody got in the act. Everybody was buying caps and drag lines on credit and going everywhere, and there was a lot of gold left too. In 42, they closed down gold mining because of the war. It never really started again to any extent. Well, I'm getting into late events that are pretty well known to everyone, and it's pretty hard to judge how important they were. There was oil exploration in the Arctic. In 57, they found the oil in the Kenai Peninsula. There hasn't been a resurgence of mining here. There was an old copper property on the Kobuk at Shungnak, and it's now called, it's a post office, is Bornite. I know that was there in 1908 because I saw an old letter from one of the Lucky Six to one of the others saying that they had discovered this copper deposit and they're bringing in steam engines and want to build a regular city there. And it didn't pan out, but about 50 years later, almost 50 years later, Reinie Berg staked it and got to sniping around, and they developed that into a very good copper property. If it was in the States, it would be working right now. But that, of course, is another story. Walter Hickel wanted to build a railroad to it. But that one mine would only support about 1/6 of the operating costs of a railroad. And I'm not sure they'd want to ship over 800 miles of rails anyway to get that stuff out of there. It's just, it's going to be there until conditions change. And there's no question about it. Of course, in 68, they struck Prudhoe Bay, and I suppose that same year or the year after ought to be famous for the great ecological crusade that started. I don't know if Prudhoe Bay will ever get to ship it. Time they do, it'll be maybe oil won't be worth anything. The last couple of years, that mining companies have been spending over about $10 million a year on exploration in Alaska. We think, I think personally, a lot of other people do, that they have already found some mines. Right now we're in a recession. I don't know that any of us are feeling it much, but there is a recession. Money for exploration is very hard to get. And then between the Native Claims Bill and what happened the other day, whether it's justified or not, they're getting pretty nervous. I doubt if one-tenth of that will be spent this year. I know one-tenth of it won't be spent. But we do believe that they're going to find, that we have already found deposits on the porphyry copper type that are producing most of the copper in Arizona and Utah. They've been traced up through British Columbia and into Yukon Territory, and we think they come right through into the 40 Mile. And I think that I know of four or five over there that have been found in the last two summers. And out of that four or five, I'm sure that there's going to be a mine. If the price of gold should somehow be doubled or quadrupled, which is possible, it's about $48 now, I think there'd be a little resurgence of gold mine, nothing to set the world on fire, but enough to repopulate some of the old camps. And this would be welcome. We have a few men out in the hills. I think this is probably about all I've got to say, because the mining industry and the history of mining now is all in the future, as far as I can see.
Does anyone have any questions that I'd like to ask Mr. Wolf?
Yes.
I just want to add the Willow Creek Mining District. It was fought in, wasn't it, in the first decade of the...
Oh, I missed that, and I've got it in my chronology here, yes.
The Hatcher Pass area in New Palma.
Yeah, it was... somehow I did miss that, but it was about, I think it was in the first decade, all right.
It was mostly gold mine.
Yeah, and it was a good district. It produced right up.
Not very big, but it was steady.
Yeah, it produced up till the Second World War, and I'm not sure they ever got one going after that. The Independents may have run for a while after that.
Yeah, they did. There were a couple of mines where they spent exploratory money,
then
the Girdwood District also, and there were some gold mines there, and they never produced very much, but they
did
spend some
money there.
That's
on the Kenai. Well, near
Anchorage.
Right? Yeah, there's a north-south road that just about goes along the railroad. There were all kinds of small gold lodes on that. None of them really became a mine. But I know that there was a little gold produced. There was a fellow that went to school at the university just after the war. Well, he's still in town, Mike Thompson. I'm sure some of you know him. He worked there at Moose Pass for a while. He had an eraster. He didn't have a mill, but they were able to pick out some high grade and grind it with an eraster.
How big was Marshall?
Oh, my guess would be, it produced steadily from 1913 until the Second World War II. I was there in 1940, and there was that camp, and there was a little subsidiary camp at Keiko Creek about 20 miles upriver. I don't know, there were probably about four or five operators at that time with drag lines and cats. Yes.
Actually, mine in
the Middle Fork, Tramway Bar produced money that was down below, but the mining on the Middle Fork, they're all right close to Wiseman, and Nolan Creek and Hammond River were the two big ones, but Gold Creek, Linda Creek, they're 12 miles above Wiseman. There were some that, what's the one there down below Wiseman now? Many, Well, the Porcupine Creek, the Stanish brothers were on that until way up in the 50s. But there's a fellow who's got a skin diving outfit. It's Lundin, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Miskovich is doing pretty good over there, too.
Yeah, he's on Porcupine, but Lundin's across the river on, I don't know if it's Minnie or not, but there's real coarse money there, and there's a canyon, and nobody could mine it, but he takes this underwater dredge, and he's doing fine. Big nuggets, and you get $120, $150 an ounce. So that's where the future, if any, the small future in placer mining is right now, is the fact that you can still own placer gold. You always could. And as pocket pieces or jewelry or mementos or whatever you want to call it, they're worth a lot of money. Andrew Miskovich, they've got coarse money too, and I'm sure he doesn't sell any for less than $100. I talked to Jack Newbar from, I didn't get Manly in there either. I must have skipped something. Manly was struck about 1901, about 1902, I think, because Gus Conrad, you know him. He was at Manly, though, when he first heard about Fairbanks, seems like. Was it later?
Getting back to kayakers, they hit some pretty rich spots there on Wild River.
Yeah, there's Rye and Jake Creek flowing into the into the lake itself. Now, I was on Michigan Creek a couple, 3 years ago looking at some quartz for someone. We didn't find anything on Michigan Creek, but then we didn't sink the bedrock. We weren't interested. We were just looking at the hard rock. But there's the interesting thing about gold here is that there's a little of it all over the country, and as a metallic province, Alaska, all of Alaska is a gold province. Give you some figures, it produced $500 million. And that's just the state share to pay out on the native claims bill. So it'll give you an idea of how much it's going to cost. That's what Alaska's produced in all history in gold.
Ernie, why did the
Kennecott
close up?
Well, I've heard all kinds of stories, but the best one I can get is that they ran out of oil.
You think they really did?
Well, they're back there. Hannah, I think, has got a lease on it, and they're underground, and they hope to open something up. But they did thousands of feet of diamond drilling before they quit. But you hear all kinds of stories about they got mad at the unions and locked out. Well, I don't think it works that way. I think you can live with the unions as long as you're making money.
But you said that was the greatest copper discovery in the world.
Yeah. Well, the rich...
They mined it all out in those few short years?
Yeah.
It was up till about 1933 or 4, someplace.
It was 38.
38.
Quit shipping.
Well, that's been a long time, man.
Bruce, you know, he said that he saw it come into Cordova and they could only get 2 sacks high on a flat car. That chalcocite is almost 80 to 79.5% copper, and it's heavy, and it's rich. And,
but the copper wasn't $27 million.
I don't know. That sounds about right. They amortized the railroad. It started Kennecott. That's where they got their name. Bear Creek comes from it. You got their name from a little creek down there. Phil Holdsworth is down there right now. He left about a week ago from Juneau. He's manager for an Exco, International Nuclear Exploration. And he studied the Kennecott deposit. The thing occurs on the contact between the Nikolai Greenstone and the Chittistone Limestone, which may not mean, it means something to some of you, but greenstone underneath that has native copper, spectrum copper, specks in it, but it's not ore. And this limestone above, it occurred up in the limestone, and he thinks that he's discovered the peculiar geologic relationship at that mine, and they explored along the contact, and he thinks he's found another one. They're going to start drilling here very shortly. I hope he does.
What is, several years ago we read about the various oil companies prospecting off a Nome. I believe there was prospecting off of barges and possibly even on the winter ice. And I believe they were prospecting for gold.
Yeah, that's right.
And is there any future in that?
Well, yeah, I think if the price goes up, there'll be a future. I think there are enough problems with the mining on land about going out there, but they did find gold. Your father was there, and he says that there's gold there, but that there are some mighty big problems, too. They've been trying to make noodle bugs work there ever since they found the district. And storms get them every time. They sank a converted dredge and barge at Bluff here about a year ago last fall. They stayed out too long and they got caught. Couldn't learn anything about it. But they drilled through the ice, all right. In fact, I think they lost a capture yet. They did.
Well, thank you very kindly for coming. We appreciate your attending. I trust we'll see you at the next meeting. And as I mentioned, it'll be at the university. It'll be announced in the paper, hopefully on the radio and TV. And we'll have a picture of the Chaco. We'll have a business meeting at 7:30. Program at 8.
The meeting will be at the university.
Well, I think I got him on here, all right. No?